This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 3rd, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, primary voting takes place in Washington, D.C., Wisconsin, and Maryland, but the focus in Wisconsin is on the recall election of Governor Scott Walker. With shooting killings in Florida, Wisconsin, and California, more attention is falling on gun laws and the political groups behind them. And U.S. immigration officials sweep up thousands of people. We'll hear about the fallout in immigrant communities. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. After years in captivity, 10 people held by Colombia's largest rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, are free today. Lily Eskenazi reports from Bogota.
Held hostage for over 12 years, the Red Cross has confirmed that the 4 soldiers and 6 police officers are in good health. The release operation was coordinated by the Red Cross, government delegates from Brazil, and human rights activists from the organization Colombians for Peace. The men freed yesterday were the last of the government security forces to be held hostage, but the FARC still holds an unknown number of civilian hostages whose fates are unclear. The FARC has pledged to stop abducting civilians for ransom and has urged the government to agree to participate in peace talks. Former senator and hostage mediator Piedad Cordoba has called for a bilateral ceasefire, with both parties pausing hostilities to negotiate a political solution to the more than 60-year armed conflict. Any sustainable solution, she says, must incorporate political prisoners into a national dialogue. The Santos government continues to negate the existence of political prisoners in the country. While many hope that the release will lead to peace, tensions between the FARC and the government remain high. Lily Eskenazi, FSRN, Bogota.
In other news from Colombia, the nation's inspector general wants the government to provide protection for leaders of the land rights movement. The country's constitutional court ordered such protection in 2010, but it has not been delivered. In an open letter to government officials, the Ombudsman for Humanitarian Affairs condemned last week's kidnapping and murder of prominent campesino leader Manuel Ruiz and his 15-year-old son. According to the online journal Semana.com, Ruiz had requested government protection 3 times before his assassination. The International Court of Justice says they will not investigate the possibility that war crimes were committed during an Israeli offensive on Gaza in 2009. FSRN's Rami El-Maghari reports.
The Palestinian Authority filed a petition with the court accusing the Israeli army of perpetrating war crimes against Palestinian civilians in Gaza during a 3-week-long attack on the coastal territory in 2009. The International Court of Justice says the petition was declined because Palestine is not a member state at the United Nations. Palestine does have a seat at the UN General Assembly, but for more than 6 decades has been defined as an observer rather than a non-member state. More than 1,400 people died in Gaza during the so-called Operation Cast Lead. Almost 1,000 were civilians, more than 400 were kids. 13 Israelis died. Rami El-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Reports of violence continue to emerge from Syria today. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says fighting is ongoing in Daraa, Idlib, Homs, and near Damascus. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Susan Rice said today that the Security Council hopes, but does not expect, that President Bashar al-Assad will meet his commitment to halt the violence by April 10th. An advance United Nations team is due in Syria in the next 2 days to plan for the arrival of up to 250 unarmed monitors. And the United Nations held an urgent session on Mali today, where the humanitarian crisis is growing. More than 200,000 people have been displaced by fighting in the country's north since the beginning of the year, and the military leader of the recent coup refuses to step aside. Amadou Timbene reports that aid groups are worried after West African leaders place strict sanctions on the country.
The Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, isolated Mali yesterday. Neighboring countries closed their borders to enforce trade, economic, and diplomatic sanctions. The move followed Junta leader Captain Amadou Sanogo's failure to hand over power to civilians. Civil society organizations are worried because the sanctions will worsen the current food crisis and will facilitate the advance of rebel groups in the north of Mali. Captain Sanogo says he has no intention of staying in in power but is calling for mediation.
If they say to do everything to make election, they say yes, it's okay. Political party, civil society, as I said, gotta put out together and to find a prime minister and make a good team.
The junta leader said Monday night that he is open to dialogue with West African leaders to end the political crisis, but some members of parliament are calling on him to step down immediately. They say the country will face a shortage of oil and food products in coming days. Amadou Tembine, FSRN, Bamako.
In Yemen, government officials say they killed as many as 43 al-Qaeda fighters during 3 days of airstrikes in Aden and Abiyan. According to Agence France-Presse, U.S. troops were involved in the military operation. Late yesterday, an oil pipeline was attacked, the second since Friday. Ansar al-Sharia, an al-Qaeda-affiliated group, claimed responsibility, saying the explosion was the second in a series of planned attacks in retribution for a U.S. drone strike on Friday that killed 5 people. And federal agents raided Oaksterdam University yesterday, along with the home of the school's founder, Richard Lee. The Oakland, California school specializes in cannabis cultivation. Federal IRS, Drug Enforcement Agency, and U.S. Marshal agents also raided the medical marijuana dispensary owned by the longtime medical marijuana activist. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Presidential primary elections take place today in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Wisconsin. The top candidates have made last-minute campaign efforts over the past few days. But in Wisconsin, the presidential race has largely been overshadowed by other news, and that's the upcoming recall election for Governor Scott Walker. A federal court has struck down parts of his cornerstone legislation restricting public unions, continuing the debate about worker rights in Wisconsin. Molly Stentz from WORT in Madison reports.
As voters go to the polls today in Wisconsin, they'll pass a variety of signs dotting people's front yards, many of them homemade. But these aren't GOP presidential signs. They're for and against the recall of Governor Scott Walker. His opponents got a boost Friday after a federal court struck down part of his controversial bill which stripped away public union rights. The same day, the state set the recall election date for the governor, the lieutenant governor, and 4 Republican senators. And the Milwaukee mayor decided to jump into the race against the governor. First, the anti-union law, which has come to be the cornerstone of the governor's term. A federal court said that, on the whole, the state government can restrict the power of public unions to negotiate. But it said the government can't do everything that the governor wanted. It can't block unions from setting up payroll deductions for their members. And it can't force unions to get a majority of all members' votes, not just a majority of the members who do vote. Susan Crawford is an attorney with the law firm Cullen Weston Pines & Bach, who brought the case against the government on behalf of several public employee unions.
And the main reasons that the court found those provisions to be unconstitutional is that the law exempted public safety employees from those requirements, and the court found that the government had presented really no reason for treating these two groups of employees differently.
Both the unions and the governor were claiming wins. Greg Mitchell from the AFSCME union in Wisconsin was encouraged by the ruling.
I would say that AFSCME is very pleased that the courts have ruled in our favor for the equal protection claims, and that we hope that the courts will see fit to overturn the whole act at some point. But if not, we're ready to fight it out with Scott Walker wherever we need to.
The main tool that unions and concerned citizens are using to carry out that fight with Scott Walker? The recall election. The election dates have now been set, and the campaigns to find the Democratic challenger are heating up. The primary election will be a month away on May 8th. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett entered the race last Friday. He's the candidate who lost to Walker in the 2010 election, but the one with the strongest ties to the state and national Democratic parties. The other frontrunner is Kathleen Falk, former Dane County executive, who led the second largest county in the state. State Senator Kathleen Vinehout and Secretary of State Doug LaFollette have also decided to run. But Walker says his opponent is really the unions.
become clear with all the money that's already been on TV that who the other side puts on the ballot's really secondary to the tens of millions of dollars we expect that out-of-state big government unions will be putting into this race. And so that's really who my opponent is. It's the out-of-state government money that's coming in. And whether it's Tom Barrett or Kathleen Falk, they're going to support that candidate ultimately to the hilt.
Once the Democrats and Republicans pick their candidates in May, they'll have about a month to campaign before the recall election on June 5th. Also at play in the recall election is the state's controversial new voter ID law. It's been temporarily suspended due to several lawsuits, but the state Supreme Court is expected to rule on it before June and could reinstate it. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
A former nursing student at an Oakland university killed at least seven people and injured others Monday when he came to the campus with a gun and shot students and faculty at random. Police told reporters the 43-year-old man, who is now in custody, had been expelled from the Christian school. This and other high-profile shooting incidents across the country, including the death of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin in Florida and Bo Morrison in Wisconsin, have intensified criticism of increasingly relaxed state gun laws and the corporations that profit from them. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more in Washington, D.C.
The shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida, sparked a national discussion about racial profiling, relaxed gun laws, and the priorities of the U.S. criminal justice system. Protests broke out across the country over the last few weeks, targeting both the local police department, who declined to charge Martin's shooter, and the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. This powerful think tank, whose leaders include former National Rifle Association executives, drafted the model legislation that became the so-called Stand Your Ground Law in Florida and dozens of other states. Lisa Graves at the Center for Media and Democracy co-founded the ALEC Exposed Project to investigate these connections.
ALEC sponsors a number of events every year in which it basically operates as one-stop shopping for state legislators and corporate lobbyists to meet at fancy resorts. At those meetings, there are ALEC task forces where corporations and politicians actually vote as equals on so-called model legislation to change the law in states across the country. And this NRA bill is a case where that bill was initially conceived of in part by the NRA and then was brought to an ALEC task force meeting. And at that meeting, corporations and politicians voted as equals to approve that bill as a model bill.
Since that meeting in 2005, 25 states have adopted some form of this bill, which allows the use of lethal force if someone feels threatened, even if they have the ability to flee. Professor Robert Beatty at Florida's Stetson Law School cited the rise in so-called justifiable homicides since the law passed in 2005, and says certain provisions make it difficult to prosecute those who misuse the doctrine of shoot first.
Once a defendant raises an argument that he was using force in self-defense, Florida law requires that the state disprove that defense beyond a reasonable doubt. And that is a very difficult burden of persuasion to place on the state.
The legal protections in the bill for shooters also trouble Graves, who says these provisions deny survivors and family members the right to due process.
It makes it harder for the victim's family to sue by basically saying if the victim's family does not prevail unanimously before a jury, it actually has to pay the shooters, the killers, lost income and attorney's fees.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker signed a bill similar to Alex last year, called the Castle Doctrine, which allows gun owners to use lethal force against someone entering their home. The law has come under fire following the shooting death of 20-year-old student Bo Morrison in March, and some lawmakers are calling for its repeal. Morrison, a biracial youth who had been hiding on the shooter's porch after a party next door was broken up by police, was unarmed. The shooter has not been charged with a crime. The legislative agenda of ALEC reaches far beyond gun laws. The group has promoted bills in several states to privatize prisons, criminalize immigration, and require a photo ID at the voting booth. Rashad Robinson with the African American advocacy group Color of Change says all of these laws disproportionately affect people of color and hopes communities will begin to protest corporate influence in the legislative process.
This tragedy of Trayvon Martin and ALEC's role in shoot first laws, if it gives us an opportunity to shine a bigger light on ALEC, then it's an opportunity that we need to take. And we need to take it, you know, not just to ensure that we get full justice for Trayvon, but to ensure that we push back against this infrastructure that has worked so hard to make life tough for so many Americans.
Robinson was one of the thousands who rallied outside ALEC's D.C. headquarters last week, calling on them to end their promotion of pro-gun legislation and disclose their corporate members and donors.
We think it's an opportunity to peel the onion of ALEC. Most folks have never heard of ALEC. ALEC, in many ways, is a nameless, faceless organization. No one sees the leader of ALEC on television or speaking in the news. This is an organization that has purposely worked to do its work behind the scenes. And they get funded by corporations to do the work behind the scenes.
Color of Change is launching a national campaign Wednesday, mobilizing communities of color to boycott companies that donate to ALEC, including Coca-Cola, Walmart, and AT&T. Some U.S. lawmakers are also promising action. Several members of the Congressional Black Caucus introduced a resolution Friday urging the repeal of the Stand Your Ground law in Florida and any state with a similar statute. The lawmakers also urged any state considering Stand Your Ground legislation to reject it. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
On Monday, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement announced the results of a sweeping six-day immigration raid, which led to arrests of more than 3,000 people in all 50 states. ICE said it was the largest of its kind, drawing on nearly 2,000 agents from 24 field offices. The nationwide raids bring up issues of deportation and detention policy under President Barack Obama. For more, we're joined by Cheryl Little, Executive Director for Americans for Immigrant Justice. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks so much.
ICE has called this operation Cross-Check, saying it was the largest of its kind. It took place in all 50 states. How does this compare to raids in the past?
You know, ICE keeps telling the public that roundups like this target dangerous criminals. It sounds great, but that's not the reality. The vast majority of immigrants rounded up pursuant to secure communities, which is ICE's largest enforcement program, target folks who are far from violent offenders. Many have only committed misdemeanor traffic violations. I mean, we're seeing Dream Act eligible kids in detention.
Well, you're outlining the kinds of people who are caught up in these raids. ICE did release some data on who was arrested during this most recent cycle of 6 days of raids. They say of those arrested, 1,477 had felony convictions. How does that stack up against these proposals put forth by the Obama administration to supposedly impose reforms on detention and deportation policy?
Well, I mean, they don't stack up. I mean, we've seen many people who, pursuant to, you know, memos from ICE and messages from the White House, should not have to worry about being deported at this time. And yet, you know, many of these folks are indeed being rounded up and placed in detention and deported. And I can tell you that, you know, families are being torn apart, and fear in our immigrant communities here in South Florida these days is palpable.
And as ICE has said, more than 3,000 people arrested in these raids. What's next for these people who have been taken into custody? What's likely a next step?
Chances are they'll be deported pretty quickly. I mean, 84% of ICE detainees have no attorney. They're not entitled to a free attorney. Oftentimes, if they don't already have a final order, they're being coerced into signing stipulated orders, waiving all their legal rights, and the next thing they know, you know, they're in a country where they haven't lived for many years.
Cheryl Little is Executive Director for the organization Americans for Immigrant Justice. She joined us from Florida. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dorian.
Cambodians are just one group of many that are affected by stepped-up immigration raids. Many Cambodians targeted for removal are from families who originally came to the U.S. in the late 1970s and early 1980s as refugees fleeing war and conflict in Southeast Asia. On FSRN, we've been covering the issue of deportees who lived most of their lives in the U.S. but were forced out of the country. Many of them now reside in Cambodia and have been advocating for changes to the immigration policy. That advocacy has taken the form of a video called My Asian Americana.
I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America,
to the republic
for which it stands,
one nation,
under God,
indivisible,
with liberty
and justice
and justice.
For all.
That video was submitted to the White House as part of a contest called What's Your Story, run by the Initiative on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, which President Barack Obama created in 2009 by an executive order. Anita Yul Ali is one of the producers of the video. She told FSRN today that the video aimed to capture the situation in Cambodia.
The issue is still very much alive, even after these young men have been dropped off here, and actually it's young men and young women, after they've been dropped off here to Phnom Penh, the government, the American government, thinks that their voices are then null and become invisible, but that's not the case. We've been able to actually talk to them and give a little bit more visibility on the issue and with presenting it from their perspective after the fact of being deported here to Cambodia.
And many of their voices are in this video. It does raise the sensitive questions of U.S. deportation policy. You've also raised questions about the selection process. What are your concerns?
What's been amazing about this is that our video went viral, and our video has the most amount of YouTube hits. And we have been tracking through our own analysis since day one when the contest opened and they had asked for the public to vote. We had been tracking numbers on that. And on the very last day of the contest, it was pretty clear from the amount of hits that we were getting that we were in a landslide win, that we were getting increasingly more and more hits, more and more viewership. And if any of that translates into votes, we for sure had the highest public votes in that case. And it's also clear that the White House changed their rules somewhere down the line and were not transparent about the process because they dismissed the public voting ours into the winning circle, and yet we were not honored with one of the top six prizes to be at the White House table. And that's pretty impossible to believe considering the popularity of the video.
That's filmmaker Anita Yul Ali speaking to us from Phnom Penh, Cambodia. FSRN's requests for clarification from the White House were not responded to by airtime. However, Eddie Lee, associate director with the Office of Public Engagement, commended the inspirational stories of the top 11 videos, but said they could only invite a select number to the White House. Across the country, police have used force to confront and restrict Occupy activists. They've battered participants with billy clubs, doused them with pepper spray, and shot them with tear gas. Law enforcement has spied on, arrested, and jailed them. Now the Oakland, Berkeley, California area district attorney is trying a new weapon, banning Occupy participants from locations where they organize and demonstrate. Occupy attorneys are pushing back. FSRN's Judith Scher reports.
Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley slapped stay-away orders on more than 13 Occupy Oakland activists. The orders bar most from being either 100 yards or 300 yards from the plaza outside City Hall, where Occupy Oakland's tent camp, dismantled by police in mid-November, was established and where meetings and organizing continues. O'Malley also hit a dozen Occupy Cal protesters with similar bans at their recent arraignments. Most were charged with misdemeanor resisting arrest and blocking a sidewalk. They cannot set foot on University of California property statewide, except to go to class or work. Pro bono attorneys for Occupy activists say the bans are unconstitutional. Javaka Kandapa represents two of the four activists with stay-away orders, named as petitioners in an American Civil Liberties Union writ of habeas corpus.
If you talk about those core First Amendment issues, which are, you know, related to their core political beliefs and involvements, clearly the stay-away order, you know, implicates all of that and prevents them from being involved in those activities. For instance, they cannot participate in attend or even observe any Occupy Oakland meetings that have traditionally been held at Franco Gawa Plaza.
District Attorney O'Malley declined interview requests, but laid out the logic of the stay-away orders in a San Francisco Chronicle editorial, stating, First Amendment rights, quote, must be and will be measured and balanced with protecting the safety of the community. She called stay-away orders vital for keeping peace in the community. O'Malley also said, Occupy activists have a, quote, mission to destroy the community fabric of Oakland through the use of violence. Candapa scuffed at the DA's characterization of demonstrators as violent. He noted that one client, an attorney, had never before been arrested.
Well, while it's clear to me that obviously there have been acts of vandalism, but by a few people, but you know, we've got to recognize that. But to paint the entire Occupy Oakland movement, which involves a few thousand people who've been involved in these demonstrations over the last several months, and to suggest that this entire movement now is one, kind of like one huge gang, it's just, you know, preposterous.
Activists from Occupy Cal say that police and the DA signaled out just a few leaders to charge and ban, even though there were 1,500 to 2,000 demonstrators November 9th. Videos from that day went viral on the internet, showing police beating students who had linked arms to defend a tent encampment. Yvette Falarca is a recent UC Berkeley graduate, a middle school teacher, and a national organizer with a campus group By Any Means Necessary. She wasn't arrested at the demonstration, but discovered she was charged with resisting arrest and maliciously blocking a sidewalk when she received notice of her arraignment. Falarca is banned from all University of California property, except to take her students on field trips there.
This is absolutely a political witch hunt by the university administration and also by the district attorney of Alameda County to attack the movement and suppress our right to defend public education. We don't accept this. All of us who are charged have either been very prominent or public organizers, you know, activists, leaders in this movement.
Like Falarca, Ricardo Gomez is a social activist leader. He's a senior at UC Berkeley. FSRN spoke to Gomez outside the courtroom just after he was arraigned on charges of resisting arrest and blocking a public sidewalk at the November 9th campus protest. Like the others similarly charged, the court banned him from all university property, except to go to class. He's got a special exemption for housing, since he lives on university property.
I think that these stay-away orders represent what the administration, the UC administration, would like to see the UC like, you know, obedient students who go to class and they don't say anything and they go home at the end of the day and they don't do anything to defend public education. So, I'm fighting for a really free public education system, not one where, you know, people don't have rights, where people aren't able to say what they need to say.
That was FSRN's Judith Scher reporting. Some of the activists in Judith's story were supposed to attend a hearing today, but that was canceled. On Monday, a judge overturned the stay-away orders issued to four of the students, including Yvette Falarca. In an email, Deputy District Attorney Teresa Drenick said after 5 months, there was, quote, no indication that any of the four defendants has violated the law or the stay-away order on UC property. She added that they don't believe that campus safety will be jeopardized by the lifting of the stay-away order. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Cobb. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.